Hello there, welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald. I'm a former Director of Public Prosecutions, a barrister practicing at Matrix Chambers and a crossbench member of the House of Lords.
And with me, Tim Owen. I'm also a member of Matrix Chambers, specialising in crime, public law, human rights law, and occasionally media law.
Well, Tim and I thought that today we would deal with a piece of legislation which is about to come before the House of Lords again, indeed on the 19th of April, and that's the Online Safety Bill. This bill is a good example of everything that's wrong with the House of Commons. It's convoluted, it's horribly drafted, it's impossible to understand. It's had very little scrutiny in the Commons, and it's basically been pushed through, whipped through by the government. And the result has been, I would say, an unmitigating disaster. But we've got someone here today as a guest who's uniquely qualified to discuss this bill and to analyse it with us, particularly from a free speech angle, the extent to which this bill impacts on free speech in good ways, or more likely, I would say, in bad ways. And our guest is, in fact, Dr. Bryn Harris, who's chief legal counsel of the Free Speech Union. Bryn read English and classics at Edinburgh, and then he took a DPhil, Doctor of Philosophy, PhD in classics at Wadham College, Oxford. The title of his DPhil thesis was Virgil's Fictions, Paradox and Anomaly in the Aeneid. I don't think we'll be touching too much on that today, Bryn. But in 2015... after he tells me his wife suggested that since he enjoyed arguing so much, he should become a lawyer. That's a reproach that many of us have heard over the years from our domestic companions. He was called to the bar in 2018. He's a non-practicing barrister, but between 2015 and 2018, he volunteered for and later directed the Speaker's Corner Trust. It's a small charity which promotes the need for civil dialogue and debate, which is a very good thing in these times. And he became interested in free speech issues, particularly at UK universities during that period. In late 2020, he began working as legal counsel for the Free Speech Union, which had launched in February of that year. And he is now, as I've said, its chief legal counsel. Bryn, welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Yes, hi, Bryn, and thanks very much for joining us to try and guide us through this impossible-to-understand piece of legislation.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Bryn, we usually ask our lawyer guests what brought them into the law, and you've given a sort of answer that you were prodded into doing it by your wife, but there must be more to it than that. What was it about the law that attracted you?
Well, it was there was actually a particular event, seeing as you ask, and it was more a realization that I wanted to be involved in certain public debates. And I became very interested in the Scottish referendum campaign. I'd lived in Scotland, obviously, to do my first degree. And, you know, I had a very particular view on the referendum. I won't say which way it was. I'll let you guess that. I sort of took part in a lot of arguments. I ended up sort of campaigning and knocking on doors, and it made me realize that you know, there are certain sort of matters of politics, sort of public reasoning, which were dear to my heart, and you know, that I really wanted to do something where I could be involved in that. So I originally became interested in sort of public law and crime. And then over time, obviously, I've sort of ended up working in, you know, an area very much connected to policy as well.
And then the Free Speech Union. Just say a little bit about the Free Speech Union has got a slightly controversial image. Some people on the left see it as a kind of right wing cultural warrior party. But you're not a person of the right, Bryn, and you're someone who presumably views it in a different way. Could you just say a little bit about the Free Speech Union and what attracted you to working there?
Yeah, of course. So the Free Speech Union is a membership organisation. We're not a trade union as such. We have 11,000 subscribing members, and we do what we can to, well, both obviously keep them informed about the debate surrounding freedom of speech, but also to assist them when they're involved in a dispute in which free speech is at stake. So very often that will be an employment dispute, maybe censured or dismissed even for something they've said, and also as well a number of university cases. I mean, I initially didn't mean to get involved in the Free Speech Union. What happened, I'd done a fair bit of work at the Speaker's Corner Trust, as you mentioned, Ken, and I left in the end because my daughter was on the way, and I had you know, a fair bit of stuff lying around, you know, documents I'd produced and resources. And then I read Toby Young's article in The Spectator where he announced he was going to set up the Free Speech Union and gave his email address. And among all the trolling messages that I imagine he received, he got one from me in which I offered to sort of pass on this work that I'd done to see if somebody could get some use out of it. And my wife, I don't want to mention her again, but my wife said, you know, you're going to get sucked into this, aren't you? It's going to take a bit of evenings and weekends. And I said, no. I'm just going to pass on these resources that I developed and, you know, pass them on. That'll be it. And then about a week later, Toby sort of rang me and said, oh, we've got a case. You know, do you want to get involved? And that was that. But in terms of the political aspect, the FSU is strictly a nonpartisan organization, and I'm probably quite a stickler for, you know, keeping to a principled definition of free speech and trying to avoid the political pressures. It's not always easy because I think free speech has become a political matter. But
You just mentioned Bryn about the Speaker's Corner Trust. I mean, what's the difference in terms of its aims and day-to-day functioning between the two?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that drew me, the main distinction that drew me, is that I think Speaker's Corner Trust, which is a fantastic organisation set up by a former Labour MP, I think it was based on the presumption that free speech is uncontroversial and that everyone believes in it as a universal value. And whereas I think the difference with FSU is that I think it was based on the premise that we actually need to advocate for free speech as a value in itself, and that there are perhaps many who are beginning to sort of recile and think, well, maybe, you know, maybe free speech isn't that important. So I think it was the fact that it was willing to do that advocacy.
Who was the MP who set it up, actually? I can't remember.
Yes, very happy to mention him. That's Peter Bradley MP, who was MP for the Rican.
I mean, it's interesting what you say, and I think we may get into this later, but it's not just that some people are resiling from free speech. There is a sort of notion out there, isn't there, amongst some groups of people, that free speech is actually a threat. It's a sort of tool of oppression. As I said in my introduction to this episode, the Online Safety Bill, the OSB, is a fiendishly complex, badly drafted bill. But it hasn't got any better following recent amendments. In fact, in many ways, it's got worse. I'm going to set you a real challenge now, which is to invite you to give our listeners a brief summary of the Online Safety Bill as it relates to free speech, the clauses that relate to speech, free speech, their history and where we are now.
So I'll take a deep breath. The aim of the Online Safety Bill is to make the UK the safest place in the world to go online. And it does this by, or purports to do this, by seeking to protect children from content that's harmful to children. It seeks to make providers, sort of online platforms in which users exchange content, it makes them take proactive steps to remove certain forms of illegal content, with a particular emphasis on child sexual exploitation content and terrorist content. And there's also a duty on these platforms, like, for instance, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, to remove common or garden illegal content that is brought to their attention. When the bill was first introduced to Parliament, there was also a duty to take action in response to content that is harmful to adults, often labelled legal but harmful content. We'll come back to the status of that, because there have been some movements there. Now, the bill, these are the basic duties on providers under the bill. It's for them to take steps to, so it is said, protect users. And those duties are then subsequently enforced by Ofcom. And this would be a fairly new role for Ofcom in terms of sort of regulating the online space. Certainly a new role for Michael Grade, the current chair of Ofcom, best known for his role in TV. Now, the bill is a bit like Germany's Network Enforcement Act, which came into force some time ago. We were all, I think, rather sort of we all rather smirked behind our sleeves at that at the time, sort of thinking it was a terribly illiberal piece of legislation that we wouldn't enact. But in fact, what we've seen is this is really a far more ambitious version of online protection than was put in place in Germany. Now, just to get on to the problems, I'll try and sketch some of the problems in the Act. Alongside these so-called safety duties about, you know, content that's harmful to children and illegal content, there are also fairly weak protections for freedom of speech. So there is a so-called cross-cutting duty to have particular regard to the need, to have particular regard to the importance of freedom of speech. Now, the problem with the bill, or a problem, I should say, is that there are very powerful incentives on the providers to comply with the safety duties and thereby avoid swinging fines from Ofcom. And in as much as it requires them to balance these duties with freedom of speech and protecting the free speech of users, there's not really much of a contest. The main thing they need to do to avoid liability and fines is to keep people safe, to remove content, and then at the end of it say, well, we've had regard to freedom of speech. Look, we've ticked the box. It was part of our process, and thereby we've complied with both duties. So the free speech duty isn't really going to bite very hard on them. In terms of some more general problems. Now, I mean, as you say, Ken, it is hideously complicated. It's been made only more complicated by the amendment process. And that's not to say there haven't been improvements. And I think just to state a very general point, and perhaps we can get into more detail later, I think a very general problem with this bill is that it conceives of the online world as a mischief in itself, sort of like dangerous dogs, or just like driving is a dangerous activity and therefore it needs to be regulated. It thinks that the web going online is a limited activity with specific dangers that need to be regulated. And the problem is, online is just a mode of living. It's a place where we live our lives and do everything in our lives. So it's sort of the equivalent of having a, you know, out of doors bill, or, you know, sort of a bill regulating what you do inside the house. It is going to be replete with unforeseen consequences because it aims to do so much. And I think that is perhaps one cause of the complication.
Bryn, I completely agree with that description of the bill. I've spent the last couple of days reading through both the current state of the bill as well as the explanatory notes. And in my 40 years as a barrister, there are four particular acts of Parliament which I've had a lot to do with, which in my view are catastrophically drafted and have generated massive quantities of litigation precisely because they are so badly thought through and ill-conceived. I mean, the Acts of Parliament, for example, the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act 2000, the Proceeds of Crime Act 2002, Police Reform Act 2002, and the Data Protection Act 1998. Now, those four Acts of Parliament all have the vice that the Online Safety Bill has, except the Online Safety Bill is so much worse. It's so much more incomprehensible, dense, and terribly drafted. I mean, it has currently 212 sections. It's 262 pages long. It's been 4 years in gestation. It's effectively five or six bills in one.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, in seeking to remove, you know, fraudulent advertising online, I know there's, I think the bill's doing that, and certainly there's a quite a powerful amendment to seek for it to do that. You know, creating a new offence about sort of, misleading communications. It's trying to do everything. Now, I should probably sort of speak from the other side just briefly. I think there is some of it that certainly from the free speech perspective is relatively uncontroversial. You know, I mean, I have a young daughter and I'm absolutely horrified by the effect that certain social media platforms can have on the mental health of young girls. So I think protecting children from harmful content I don't have such a problem with. Similarly, obviously, with ensuring the removal of terrorist content and child sexual exploitation content. I think the problem, and we'll probably come back to legal but harmful. We'll need to cover that at some point. I think the problem is that the over precaution that is likely to be prompted by this bill will result in the removal of far more than illegal content. The idea that I think a former DPP will know this better than anyone. The idea that a provider like Twitter or Facebook will be able to determine if content is likely to be illegal, taking into account the elements of the offence, the mental element and the defences, and that is exactly what the bill is asking. I mean, that's difficult for prosecutors.
On that point, Bryn, because I've been aching to read this into the record, so that in the hope that members of the House of Lords or members of Parliament who are listening to this podcast focus on it. You've mentioned the question about children and protecting children from harm, which of course everybody would agree with. The question is whether this bill creates anything that is remotely coherent. So if you look at Section 10 of the bill, or Clause 10, it deals with user-to-user services likely to be accessed by children, which is effectively all social media platforms, as far as I can see. And Clause 10 says, children's risk assessment duties, subsection 1. This section sets out the duties about risk assessments, which apply in relation to regulated user-to-user services that are likely to be accessed by children, brackets, in addition to the duties about risk assessments set out in Section 8. But it seems to me almost every website is likely to be accessed by a child, in one sense. And then you look at subsection 6 of this section, and I need to read this into the record. A children's risk assessment of a service of a particular kind means an assessment of the following matters, taking into account the risk profile that relates to services of that kind, subsection A. The user base, including the number of users who are children in different age groups. B. The level of risk of children who are users of the service encountering the following by means of the service, Roman 1. Each kind of primary priority content that is harmful to children, brackets, with each kind separately assessed. Roman 2, each kind of priority content that is harmful to children, brackets, with each kind separately assessed. And Roman 3, non-designated content that is harmful to children, giving separate consideration to children in different age groups and taking into account, brackets, in particular, algorithms by the service and how easily, quickly and widely content may be disseminated by means of the service. Subsection C, the level of risk of harm to children presented by different kinds of content that is harmful to children, giving separate consideration to children in different age groups. D, the level of risk of harm to children present content that is harmful to children which particularly affects individuals with a certain characteristic or members of a certain group. E, the level of risk of functionalities of the service facilitating the presence or dissemination of content that is harmful to children, identifying and assessing those functionalities that present higher levels of risk, including functionalities, Roman 1, enabling adults to search for other users of the service, brackets, including children, and Roman 2, enabling adults to contact other users, brackets, including children, by means of the service, subsection F, the different ways in which the service is used and the impact of such use on the level of risk of harm that might be suffered by children, subsection G, the nature and severity of the harm that might be suffered by children from the matters identified in accordance with paragraphs B to F, giving separate consideration to children in different age groups. And finally, H, how the design and operation of the service, including the business model, governance, use of proactive technology, measures to promote users' media literacy and safe use of the service and other systems and processes may reduce or increase the risks identified. That is section 10, subsection 6 of an act that is 212 sections long, and it's dealing with risk assessments.
Yeah, and there's plenty more like it, Tim. I mean, what you've read out is a very good representation of what's going on in this bill, and it's something that I mentioned earlier, which is the way the House of Commons works. If a bill has bi-party support generally, as this one did, it goes through the Commons with minimal scrutiny, and it's only the force of public debate that forces changes. I mean, a very good example is Nadine Dorris's clauses on lawful but harmful. So in its original form, this bill contained clauses that required, in some circumstances, providers to take down material that was considered to be lawful, entirely lawful material, but could be harmful. And this had obvious free speech implications, which caused a lot of upset, including in parts of the Conservative commentariat. So that has now been abandoned. This bill has been through four prime ministers and five secretaries of state. It has never had a consistent theme to it, and it's we now end up with them, the government claiming that it has three basic proposals. One, providers must remove illegal content. Fine, none of us disagree with that. Obviously, providers should be removing illegal content, and they failed lamentably to do so in the past. Secondly, that providers should, and this is part of the rowback from lawful but harmful, should remove material that violates their terms of service. In other words, if there's anything up on a site that violates that provider's terms of service, which presumably will include things like you must not be abusive or unpleasant, you must not break the law, blah, 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 they will be under an obligation to remove it. And thirdly, and I find this one quite amusing, actually, the providers have to give users the power to opt out of harmful content. Well, I'm very grateful. The best way of opting out of harmful content is not to look at it or to switch off your computer. But this is now a legal duty. So, I mean, in a way, you can present all this as being rational and reasonable. But the problem is that in practice, when you get down to how is this going to be enforced, how are the providers going to respond? You know, how are the consumers going to respond? How is Ofcom going to respond to actions taken or not taken? And you get trapped in the sort of clauses that Tim's just been reading out, which frankly put your head in a spin. I mean, it's just a nightmare, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I mean, I think there have been improvements in, as you say, the provisions regarding legal but harmful have been removed.
That's in relation to adults, isn't it?
It is. You know, if you look at the amendment paper in the Lords, there's a degree of appetite to put that back in. The so-called user empowerment duties, Ken, that you just mentioned, which is where, you know, users can choose the extent to which they're exposed to harm. I mean, I think there's, well, I think, you know, not, you know, having nothing would be better, but given that was politically difficult, you know, this was something along the lines of sort of, you know, like video classification, allow adults to you know, make a decision, an informed decision on whether they want to see the content.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. That's fair. I mean, I can see that.
Whether it will be practically doable is another matter entirely. But I think one thing, Ken, that is very important is, and you brought it up, this is the question of compliance with terms of service. And this is a new duty that's been added on amendment. And I think what we're concerned about is that this rather weak cross-cutting free speech duty, it's not clear to me that will feed through into the terms of service. It's not clear that those terms will have to be free speech compliant.
I mean, the problem is that as you said earlier, I think, Bryn, the risk is that service providers will be cautious and risk averse, and will have in their terms of service items and clauses which allow them very wide discretion on what to keep up and what to take down. And I think if you're a service provider, rather than run the risk of tangling with Ofcom, particularly with the kind of drafting and legislative processes that Tim has been running through, just don't put it up in the first place. Just don't put up controversial stuff. Don't allow people to express controversial opinions. Keep everything vanilla. I mean, if I was running a major service provider, I would be saying to my staff, let's keep it vanilla. We don't want to be this. None of us understand these rules. None of us understand this ballpark. We don't know what the hell Ofcom is going to do about any of this. Let's just keep it vanilla.
I think, you know, the bill is creeping towards, you know, a complete logjam. And in a way, that's quite desirable. What I mean is that the more that you increase gradually the free speech protections in the bill, the more it becomes plain that providers will have to remove content that is illegal and only content that's illegal. They will have to be utterly precise, because if they don't remove it, they'll be in breach of the illegal content duties. But if they over-remove, then they'll be in breach of the free speech protections. Now, You might say that this bill is going to end up giving providers a completely impossible job of you know, both removing illegal content, but you know, also protecting free speech. And I think it is desirable that the bill does that, because lawmakers need to know that what they are doing is impossible. You cannot protect free speech while at the same time seeking to prevent people from harm. You have to prioritize those two values, and that's what our parliamentarians are meant to do for us. And instead, what they're doing is that they're creating this this aporia, this sort of unmanageable meeting of two priorities, because they don't have the intellectual courage to say, we think one is more important than the other, is to be prioritized over the other.
Can I just come back at you? You were critical of the bill, not just in terms of incoherence and so on, complexity, but also you were suggesting that it is not doing anything to advance or protect free speech protections. But I mean, the one thing that did strike me amidst this complete mess of legislation is that there's a one bit early on, there's section 13, which is the duty to protect content of democratic importance. There's section 14, the duty to protect news publisher content. And then there's the duty to protect journalistic content in section clause 15. And if you go back to clause 13, it says this section sets out the duties to protect content of democratic importance, which apply in relation to category one services. And category one services are all the main social media platforms, Facebook, from which most people get their news these days. And what this section is doing is, in a sense, introducing a duty which doesn't currently exist to ensure that social media platforms don't remove content which is of democratic importance, and so on. And so it in one sense, you could say that this at least is introducing a method of regulating what the social media platforms are currently doing, which is, you know, a form of censorship day in, day out. You know, I watched an interesting debate between Fraser Nelson and Damien Collins, the former chair of the Digital Media Sports Committee. And Fraser Nelson is very critical of the bill, and he was making the point that the whole way the algorithms work at the moment, you know, he quoted an example of putting a spectator article that got removed, or a reading of an article got removed from all the social media platforms, is by Lionel Shriver, because the algorithms clearly said, oh, what she's saying is deeply, I can't remember, to do with vaccines or something like that. And it was just removed, it disappeared. Well, this bill, at least on its face, is designed to ensure that that kind of censorship adopted by social media platforms will be unlawful.
I mean, that's right. Just before you answer, Bryn, I mean, that does go some way to answering the vanilla point that I was making, if it's in force. So companies wouldn't be able to have algorithms that simply screened all of that stuff out. So I agree with Tim that some of those protections in those clauses are new and they're very welcome. And on the other side, since we've been so rude about the bill, it's obviously right, isn't it, that some of the protections for children are in there. I mean, let's not forget, one of the great motivations behind the online harms bill, as it was then under Theresa May's government when this was first conceived, was the terrible case of Molly Russell, the schoolgirl who died after having visited various online harm and suicide forums. And so there is, and there's a lot of public feeling about this, that children are particularly at risk. It may be a shame that the government has mixed up children and adults. And it may be a shame that they didn't restrict this bill simply to promoting the sort of clauses that Tim's just been referred to on the one hand, and protecting children on the other. It'd been a lot simpler and a lot easier to support if the bill had had that sort of framework.
I mean, I think there was potentially a juncture when there was a new Secretary of State, when Michelle Donnellan took over. I think there was potentially an opportunity there to really radically pare back the bill. Now that and she did make, you know, improvements, but I think we lost the opportunity to secure the sort of bill that you're talking about there, Ken. But going back, Tim, to content of democratic importance, I think absolutely we must be fair. Now, Nadine Dorries made a very big show of saying people complain about the restrictions on free speech, on online content, but this is entirely radical. You for the first time ever, you have a free speech protection for online content. True, but I think there are two important things, at the least, certainly regarding Clause 13, content of democratic importance, that we need to address. First, it's another fairly weak process duty. It's not an outcome duty. It's a matter of taking into account the importance of content of democratic importance. Now, I think, you know, that's pretty easily done away with. The other issue, and I think this goes to a broader issue in how we define politics in law, as the civil service drafters understand content of democratic importance, that means matters that are subject to debate in democratic institutions. So not necessarily matters that are of general public interest, or for instance, cultural politics. So for instance, if Parliament discusses or debates, deliberates on reform of the Gender Recognition Act, then that will be content of democratic importance. If the next day it debates widgets, that will be a content of democratic importance, but only if Parliament debates it. And the definition of politics is much broader now. It doesn't just include party politics.
Actually, is that right, Bryn? Because the subsection defines content of democratic importance as the content is or appears to be specifically intended to contribute to democratic political debate in the UK or a part or area of the UK. That's pretty broad.
But it doesn't define what democratic political debate means. Now, the question must be, what is the difference between democratic political debate and political debate? You know, what is democratic adding? Presumably, and this is the interpretation of the Bill team, is that it specifically means taking part in democratic institutions. Now, I know it's not up to them what the act will mean when it's law, but what I think is fairly clear is that they've missed an opportunity to align the definition with the expansive definition of political debate in the convention. And I think that that is necessary because our definition of politics is rapidly expanding beyond Westminster politics.
I was just going to make that point, actually, that the Strasbourg Court, the European Court of Human Rights, gives a very expansive view to the notion of political speech. And it is indeed interesting that the drafters of this legislation have chosen not to use that expression. I mean, lawyers all understand what that expression means. Parliamentarians, by and large, I hope, understand what it means. But they've chosen a different expression, which is, what was it again, democratic?
Democratic political debate.
Democratic political debate. So I mean, it is interesting as to why they've...
Well, I mean, it may be the Trump clause, i.e. the one addressing Twitter's removal of Trump's account.
I would have thought the courts would be keen anyway to give pretty expansive meaning to that expression.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just before you go on, Ken, I mean, the other point I wanted to make here is that in any event, all of this is taking place in the context of Article 10 being directly applicable anyway, Article 10 of the European Convention of Human Rights being applicable. So this is simply a specific domestic law duty. And I would have thought any court, if asked, is going to give that provision an extremely broad Article 10 compliant construction.
One would hope. So I answer your question, Tim. Now, regarding the protections for news publisher content and journalistic content, the distinction between those two is new and, as far as I can see, inscrutable. But
yes, I agree.
I need to read it a bit closer, perhaps. Now, there is one drawback, which we are a little bit concerned about. Now, the definition of news publisher content, I think, seems to have been assiduously lobbied by the media, by people seeking to protect press freedom. And I think that is fantastic. And they've evidently, I think, done a good job of getting those protections in there. There is one drawback, and this is the definition of a news publisher, a publisher of news content. This is at Clause 50, where it very clearly seems to exclude the citizen journalist. Now, you know, we know the citizen journalist can be a terrible pain in the ass, you know, a terrible bore. But nevertheless, you know, the law protects them still. And, you know, there was a fantastic judgment by Martin Chamberlain recently,
yes,
setting out exactly how the law protects the citizen blogger journalist as much as it does the titles of Fleet Street. At the moment, so the provision that essentially rules out the citizen blogger is the requirement there must be, I think, more than one person producing the content, and also that it, you know, it has to have a standards code, and that can be a self-drafted standards code, and it must be based in the UK. So it could be difficult, I think, for citizen bloggers to meet that definition. And that, you know, that is a shame.
Yeah, I mean, actually, Section 50 lists who is a recognised news publisher.
Yeah.
And they're all effectively regulated bodies. So it's the BBC, S4C in Wales, and the holder of a licence under the Broadcasting Act. Yeah, so it's, I mean, it clearly does not include ordinary bloggers.
And if you look, but if you look below that, there's a series of criteria as well after that.
Yeah.
Which catching all the others. We think, you know, Guido Fawkes wouldn't be covered, for instance, because he's not established in the UK.
I think before we leave the bill, we ought to acknowledge that there is a problem here and a lot of public concern, which goes beyond assertion of free speech rights and goes beyond protecting children, and that is the kind of level of threat and abuse and intimidation that seems to be out there, particularly directed against women. I think we should also acknowledge that, and particularly against women who are prominent in public life, misogyny, threats. I mean, of course, if there are death threats and rape threats and all the rest of it, those are already criminal offences. But there is a strong feeling that some form of regulation of behaviour is required, as it is in everyday life. I mean, if I walk down the street shouting four-letter words, I'm probably going to get my collar felt and taken off to the police station and charged with something or other. And so what do we do about that feeling? I mean, I don't think this bill meets it. And it may just be that this bill is an illustration of why it's just too complex to meet this problem. But that will sound to a lot of people who have been subjected to this behaviour to be pretty weak.
I mean, yes, exactly. And I mean, just to answer in a pretty vague way, first of all, I think a major systemic problem with this bill and with the thinking underlying it, it is a massive over assessment of what the law can successfully regulate. This would bring a huge amount of day-to-day interactions under the forensic sort of judicial microscope. And I don't think liberal societies should be under that extent of state scrutiny. But I also raise serious questions as to the institutional competence of courts to be involved in that level of just day-to-day interaction. Regulating decisions and the use of power is one thing. Regulating interactions between citizens is another thing. I'll get that general waffle out of the way. Ken, I mean, I completely agree. And one thing that surprises me is that we won the argument on legal but harmful without having to address the strongest arguments for it. I dreaded someone saying to me, then what should we do about people who send racist emojis to footballers? For me, I mean, so as you know, as you remember the amount of racist
the
abuse,
Euro championships.
Now that for me seemed to be a paradigmatic justification for some sort of regulation against the most sort of toxic forms of abuse.
I mean, those were criminal offences. Some of the people who posted that stuff were prosecuted.
I mean, that's often the answer, I think, isn't it? Isn't it that very often, I mean, the behaviour that I read about in the newspapers, women MPs, the sort of messages they get, those messages are criminal offences. And if the people who are sending them can be identified, that's a big if. If they can be identified, generally they're prosecuted. What about when they can't be identified? What's the responsibility of the provider to prevent that sort of material from being processed by the algorithm and passed on? That's the issue, isn't it?
But I mean, I think my response is, so, you know, even in those instances of you know, toxic racial abuse that may not constitute a criminal offence, I think there are forms of harm where we would expect something to be done. And I think what we have to do is to insist on the rigor of the rule of law and to say that, well, if we think it is unacceptable, then we must forbid it and outlaw it in a clear and certain way. And what we can't do is try to create this gray area category of you know, conduct that's harmful but still legal.
I mean, David Davis MP made a contribution during second reading, He said, look, he was critical of the bill, the size, the gestation period, that it was a monster, that it was, you know, completely beyond redemption in one sense. But what he said, look, there was a time where the Companies Act was revisited every year because there were lots of changes and modern things that would happen, and you'd revisit and you'd re-legislate or you'd amend. And that he said that rather than try to come up with this concept of harm, you've got to stick rigidly, I think is what he was saying, to the concept of illegality. And then you review what's illegal, the behaviour, and you make it illegal as and when things develop. But you do not allow a bill to go on the statute book, which has this nebulous concept of harm in relation here to children. I mean, what do you think about that?
No, I mean, I completely agree. And one of your previous guests, Kathleen Stock, with her usual acuity, put her finger on the issue without using the term, but on the issue that statutes always speak, and that what we called harm 10 years ago is, what we call harm now would be almost unrecognizable to someone 10 years ago. It's a term which has expanded rapidly, so that if we simply put harm on the statute book in this act with a very minimal definition, then it is a minimal definition, it is completely unforeseeable what it would catch in 10 years' time.
I mean, I think David Davis was really onto something there, that we constantly, and this is what Parliament does, it constantly reviews what's presently lawful that perhaps shouldn't be lawful, and obviously social media and the internet has brought quite a lot of behaviour into play that wouldn't have been in play 25 years ago. As I say, the problem I think is when stuff is passed anonymously around, so there's no putative defendant, and the question then is what should the algorithm do? I fear the risk of this bill is that the algorithm will be overly protective, and a lot of discourse, a robust discourse, will be closed down. But this may be a conundrum which simply can't be solved. It's certainly not going to be solved by the bill that we've been talking about. I just wanted, before we finish, Bryn, to get into a slightly broader discussion about free speech. And I rather trailed this at the beginning. I mean, it strikes me in many quarters, free speech is now seen, this started in America, but as ever it came over here, and now it's to be seen in France and Germany as well. Free speech is somehow a right-wing issue, that free speech is a power which is wielded by elites against those who are powerless. I mean, when I was growing up, we always believed that free speech was a tool of liberation. It was a tool of oppressed people to wield against their rulers. And a good deal of English social and political history seems to demonstrate that. How is this flipped? Is it just a byproduct of American racial politics transplanted to an entirely inappropriate environment here in Europe? Or is there something more fundamental going on?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this. And I mean, to give, first of all, a slightly superficial answer that doesn't quite get to what you're talking about, but I'll come back to it. I think, to a degree, given our lamentable culture war, which is a reality, much as we may not like that, I think to a degree, free speech has become a concern of the right, more often than it is a concern of the left. And there probably is greater skepticism about free speech on the left at the moment than there is on the right. And I think as a basic statement of fact, that seems to be true. I think one explanation of that, I think there are many, we're not going to get into all of them, but like one explanation of that is simply, to a degree, and this is contestable, it's a matter of where cultural and institutional power lies, in the sense that, this is my view, and you may contest it, I think Tony Blair was so gargantuanly successful in reshaping society that I think he probably did create a certain fairly left-wing, moderate left-wing cultural and institutional elite. And that everyone becomes a supporter of free speech when it's their free speech under threat. And so I think it's partly because there is to a degree, there's a left-wing orthodoxy, and to a degree, people on the right are the punks and the rebels. And I think in that situation, whoever's taking whichever role, you know, one favors free speech more than the other. But I realize you might want to come back on that, but to address your question properly, Ken, why is it that people are not seeing how free speech is more than a culture war football, that it has respectable, solid places in both left-wing philosophy and right-wing philosophy. Maybe one of your listeners can fact-check this, but there was a survey of Labour MPs entering the Commons in the 1930s, probably some of the earliest Labour influx into Parliament. And they were asked to name the key texts that shaped their political philosophy. Now, one of them, very common at the time, was Pilgrim's Progress by Bunyan. And the second was On Liberty by John Stuart Mill. Because, as you say, free speech was the protection of the vulnerable, the marginalized, the poor. And there is no restriction on freedom of speech which will perfectly target the privileged and the powerful. There is no restriction on free speech that won't also end up disadvantaging those, you know, the poorest, those without power. And I think that's the fundamental mistake.
But that sounds like a sort of absolutist position, which I'm not sure you're actually advocating. I mean, isn't it the case? I mean, there've always been, this is not a new controversy, about how you get the balance right. I mean, we won't go back as far as Virgil and the Aeneid, which you're familiar to, but if we go back to John Milton, so he wrote Areopagitica in 1644 in protest about government censorship, and his essay criticised the registration of all publications by the Stationers' Company, because the invention of the printing press in the century before led to government censoring written material. And in advocating what was the open marketplace of ideas theory, he questioned the efficacy of censorship, because truth will always win over falsity, as people will choose truth and they will reject falsehood. On the other hand, Milton didn't believe that Catholics should have freedom of expression. But the point is the difference now that the open marketplace of ideas theory, that truth will always win over falsity, people don't believe that anymore. And whether, you know, whether the internet and the way in which communications over the internet and you know, Trump's victory and the lies about, you know, most recently the, you know, the big lie, the election steal, people don't believe that truth will win. And so there's a desire, particularly on the left, to censor, to get true facts. You know, they will be the people who will identify the true facts, and they'll want to censor people who they believe are propagating lies.
I mean, I think, you know, one reason that we can't be as certain as Milton is that, you know, alongside his fanatical contempt for Catholics, you know, he also believed that our pursuit of truth would be governed by what he called right reason, that is our sort of inner instinct for God's truth. So, you know, for Milton, we had a sort of truth seeker inside us. And so he felt that, you know, we would wander our way with wandering steps and slow, to quote final words of Paradise Lost, we would, you know, take our wandering steps and slow through the marketplace of ideas, and right reason would guide us to the truth. Now, obviously, we can't have that, what you might call epistemological certainty, because we are skeptical. And so then the question is, therefore, should we have doubtless well-meaning guardians or philosopher kings who state for us what exactly we should know and what we shouldn't? And the problem with this, and for me this fallacy underlines almost every restriction on free speech, is there's a presumption that somebody knows what we should, what we ought to know. They know the arguments that we need to make. And the point is, we never do. And this is fundamental to Mill's philosophy. He said, we never know the truths that we need to find out, and we can only keep on blundering through. And there's not this view from nowhere, the person who is sufficiently wise and all-knowing, that they can say, these are the arguments that will lead us to truth, and these ones are fake. We can only have it out.
Anyway, the genie's out of the bottle anyway, isn't it? We're in the middle of this cacophony, and we're told everyone has their own truth, and that may be one of the issues, that there's a lessening of belief in objective truth and in scientific rigor. You know, people believe what they want to believe. This is part of this sort of idea that you can be anything you want to be, you can do anything you want to do, and these are usually ideologies that have no real attachment to real life, but they're quite powerful as a kind of personal belief system. Of course, quite a lot of this is what used to be called political correctness, was just people becoming more polite and genteel with each other. I mean, certain words were no longer acceptable to express, rightly so. Certain modes of expression became unacceptable, impolite first, then unacceptable, and then finally unlawful. And that, some of that's not necessarily a bad process. I mean, people shouldn't be able to go up to members of racial minorities in the street and abuse them with racist epithets. That should be illegal. I mean, 100 years ago, it wouldn't have been illegal at all. So some of this is progress. The real problem is determining the extent to which speech, which is dangerous, speech which is harmful, genuinely dangerous, genuinely harmful, is controlled without without undesirable consequences. That's a real problem, which this bill, and it's a test that this bill, I think, comprehensively fails.
You know, exactly. And I mean, you know, we always think historically of seditious libel as something that was there to protect the interests of the powerful, of the crown. But it was also a tool for protecting England's nascent Jewish community against, you know, lies that incited serious violence against them. Now, I'm in no way a free speech fundamentalist. I'm probably a bit of a wet within the circles that I move. I'm not really in opposition to some of the restrictions that you say there. I think my guiding sort of a principle, in as much as I have one, is that the main reason to oppose restriction on free speech actually has a very prosaic basis. I've probably hinted at it already, which is that the law will never be precise enough such that it can perfectly identify those harmful, gratuitous, awful things, while at the same time preserving a legitimate, robust, open debate. And it's because of that imprecision, because drafting is just never precise enough, that we should err in favor of liberty, so essentially we keep on arguing and find truth, find fact.
Well, thank you, Bryn, very much indeed. That really has been, I always say this at the end of an episode of Double Jeopardy, because they always are very interesting conversations, and this has been no exception. Thank you very much for your time, and no doubt when this bill finally passes into law, which I suspect it will at some stage, we can continue this discussion and look at what we actually ended up with. But I don't think it's going to be anything great. Thanks very much for joining us, Bryn.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bryn, thank you so much. I suppose to end, the only good news for people listening to this out there, particularly young lawyers, is that if this bill gets on the statute book, it is going to generate a massive amount of work for lawyers. And I mean, Ofcom will be advertising to recruit, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, I would have thought, to deal with the consequences of this bill. But anyway, let's see what happens. Thank you very much, Bryn. You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Ken MacDonald and with me, Tim Owen. If you've enjoyed this episode, please look at our back catalogue and start listening to them. There's a whole load of interesting guests that we've had over the past 26 episodes. And please tell your friends, spread the word, and follow us on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts. We'll be back with you in a week or so. Our editor is Billy Lawrence, and our social media advisor is Jess Jones.